Maybe people could move down.
Okay, well, thanks for coming. We're here to discuss transformation, I suppose, and transition and adaptation, specifically a literary work into a musical slash literary work, a play transformed into a libretto, and the libretto then taken to by the composer into the work we call opera. Just a little bit, though, we call it opera, which literally means work, but when the opera was founded way back in 1600 in Florence by a group called the Camerata, the original title was Opera in Musica, which is a drama to be sung with instrumental accompaniment. And they were trying to recreate what they believed the Greeks did, which is sung the plays, the Greek plays. It's always been what's more important, the music and the words. It's an interesting idea. Salieri, who got a bad rap in Amadeus, so for supposedly poisoning Mozart, he wrote an opera called Prima la Musica e poi la Parola, first the music, then the words. But it's meant to be a satire, so it's a... But the most interesting, I think, is in 1945. I'm almost as old as that, but more than 50. Richard Strauss's last opera, which is called Capriccio, the countess in the opera must decide between what's more important, the words or the music, specifically the characters, the poet or the musician. And she comes to the realization that since she is, in fact, a character in an opera, what she needs is both the words and the music, and it's left unresolved. Maureen Hunter wrote Transit of Venus late 80s?
It premiered in 1992.
And I remember, and much to my chagrin, I suppose, Victor Davies visiting my office. We're not quite agreed on. It was before the Pan Am Games, however.
We think so.
So 97, 98-ish, looking for subjects for opera. And I gave him some things, various plays and so on, but I didn't give him the Transit of Venus, which I now regret, of course. However, he did come to find the Transit of Venus, and maybe that's the first story to tell, is how you actually came to... This is a piece we are going to do.
I directed the first production at the Manitoba Theater Center in 1992, and when Maureen and I were working on the play, I was also the dramaturge, so we spent a lot of time together over about a two or two and a half year period working on the play. And I remember telling her throughout the process, and then particularly when we got into rehearsal, I could see the piece live on its feet, that this was really an opera we were working on. And so the play had its premiere at MTC, and then I did it again at Persephone in 93, and then it had productions across the country, and it sort of, as plays do, went through its life cycle. And in 1999, Victor and I were working on the Pan Am Games together, and because that was such a slow, boring process, we didn't have anything to do one afternoon. We started to talk about opera, because that's what you do when you work on events, and there's really nothing else to do. And
especially big ones like that, where there's nothing to do.
And it was only 5,000 performers to take care of. But anyway, and I said to Victor, Victor, you know, I did this play a long time ago. You know, I think it would be a really interesting a project to adapt as an opera. You should take a look at it sometime. And, you can tell the rest of it.
So Larry gave me the play, and I read it, and I said, I don't see it as an opera at all. Too many words, Larry. Like, too many notes, too many words. So anyway.
So, lo and behold, some years later, I become the general director of Manitoba Opera, and this thing is just floating around in the back of my mind, and the opportunity comes up that... You know, maybe we should really look at trying to take this work and adapt it in the opera. And so I phoned up my good friend Victor Davies and said, Victor, you know, I'm really thinking about actually doing this now. So you should have another look at it. And so he gets a copy of the play and has a look at it. And then what does he say?
Great idea.
So that's sort of how this project sort of got rolling. It has been sort of a long time in the making, but really sort of getting down to brass tacks in the last couple of years.
I have to say, I'm glad Larry asked me again, because it's quite a fantastic in there, in the bones of the story and the opera and the characters. It's a fantastic story for opera, absolutely remarkable. So,
and they came to you, I guess. And did you see it as a libretto? And did you want to take on that challenge?
Okay. I did want to try it. I think I've been looking to broaden my scope a little bit, and I think at one point Larry said there was a libretto writing workshop in Victoria, and maybe I should go out and take that. So I went out and spent a week in Victoria, that was about three, four years ago, and working with composers and writing music for them to set, writing words for them to set to music, and talking with the people there about the process of turning a play into an opera, and the sort of idiosyncrasies of writing for the voice. So that was a terrific introduction, and then I guess things started to get more and more serious about the project, and Larry and I, 2 summers ago, spent a lot of time going through the play, talking about what we could leave in and what we could take out, and because we knew it would have to be shortened. And I wrote a preliminary draft, and then Victor came on stream, and after that, I think there were about 12 more drafts as we honed to get to the point where I think I'm on draft 14 now, and getting pretty close to production. So,
okay. Well, Transit of Venus is about everything, and I think opera is about everything. It's about love, certainly. It's about science. It's about religion. It's about God. It's not so much about religion in a traditional sense. It's also about class. And one of the things you've done is, of course, being an opera, you decided to add a chorus, which I think brings out the class distinctions, the servants and the upper class and so on. Could you talk a little bit about that, about why you wanted this chorus? And
sure.
As composer, as a director, as
a well, from the company's point of view, we picked Transit for an awful lot of reasons. One, because it's a great play. The characters have lived on the stage dramatically already. It's following a model that a lot of great composers have used in the past. Composers have looked to the theater for source material. Barber of Seville, Marriage of Figaro, all the Shakespeare operas, Tosca. It was sort of natural to look to the theater. Then we, because it's our first new opera, we also wanted it to feel like an opera for our audience. And one of the characteristics of opera is having choral works in it. So from a kind of practical point of view, from the producer, that was one of the reasons why we talked about why I wanted to have a chorus in it, is to sort of fit the idea of opera that way. And then it was to figure out, okay, so now if we're going to add this structure onto it, what do we do with it, and what role, what dramatic role do they serve in the story, and where do we put them? And you guys want to talk about that?
Yeah, I think we all felt the need for a chorus. This was a play with 5 characters, so the obvious thing would be that the chorus would be servants in the house, and I think we wanted them to reflect sort of what was happening to the men and the women in the story, because it's very much a play about what men can do or could do in the 18th century, which women couldn't do, and how their lives went in different directions, and how their needs were different and met in different ways. And so the chorus as it has evolved appears, it reflects, I guess, I would say more gender than class in a sense, although whereas before the astronomer's life and ambitions affected the other 4 characters in the play, now it affects everyone involved. So all of the servants are affected by the choices that he makes. Do you want to add to that?
Well, the when we first started talking about the course, I recall that we talked about what are we going to do with this course? What are they? You know, how could they be involved? And my first suggestion was, well, could they be outside the frame? Could they be commenting the action? Could they be like a Greek chorus? Mm-hmm. And well, after discussion, that didn't seem to be a very appropriate. You know, it didn't really intensify the drama. It kind of distanced the chorus from what was going on. So the servants were arrived at, and I think it's a very, very good solution. I think it works quite well.
Okay. You talked a bit, Victor, about character building and using, because there is a lot of set drama, set genre ideas in opera. You have an aria here, you have a duet there. So in the adaptation of that, did you sort of drive that, or did Maureen think, you know, that's a big monologue, but that should be a duet, you know? That.
Well, the play is very linear. I mean, very, very linear. I mean, there's not a lot of places where there can be simultaneous kind of expressions of emotion. There's a duet at the end of the first act. There's a duet at the end of the second act. There's a duet for the two women.
There's a trio
for the women. We had to kind of work hard to find spots where we could actually have that simultaneous thing going mm-hmm. on, because just of the kind of the constant unfolding a narrative nature of the piece. But when I first saw the draft that Maureen had when I came on board, there were kind of aria type things in it, but there were other things that I said to Maureen, well, don't do the, you know, I can see that you've, I think you've studied libretto writing. Just forget that. And started asking questions about the characters, because I think there were conventions that were superimposed on the truth of the characters. Right. And I said, you've got to go back and find the truth of those characters. He goes, that's so much more important than any convention that we'll do.
That would drive the convention rather than the other way around.
And so the opera is full of numbers in mm-hmm. a sense, but they're very organic to the kind of the whole narrative line that goes through the whole piece.
Okay. And you were satisfied with that, or the Maureen?
Yeah. I think it's where I actually think the choral numbers for one thing are some of the prettiest music that's in the opera now, and I think that it was much easier to go back and just, you know, cut words and phrases than it was to what I was trying to do initially, which was a whole scale readaptation of the whole story.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just a question as an opera fan, though. Voice types. Did you, when you read the libretto or read the play, think, yeah, Le Gentil should be a baritone and should be a high soprano? And did you think about that, or was it a? Did you, in fact, Larry, have a cast in mind? Because one of the things about opera, even today, is it's always written for specific singers, or very much written still for specific singers. And the history of opera has that.
And that was the case. Okay. I had a cast in mind, and it's the cast we have, actually. So there was that, too. But even when I talked with Maureen about doing it, even talking with Victor, I sort of expressed my point of view about what voice types I thought would serve the characters best as well. And with the cast that I had in mind. So it was sort of a combination of the two.
It's interesting in watching the play, because that seemed to be, when I first watched the play, you had almost voice types. Did you even think about that in writing unconsciously?
No, not at all. Maybe Larry was thinking about it, but I wasn't.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. I've only come to opera basically since Transit of Venus. I started to get interested in it and going to see it. And before that, I really had hardly heard one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't quite know what else to mention, or maybe we should move on to.
Why don't we hear some excerpts?
Hear the excerpts.
So I think Maureen.
So Maureen's going to tell us
a little bit about
what the heck's going on here.
Well, I don't know how many of you saw the play or remember the play, but it's set in the 18th century in France. It's based on the real life astronomer. And you might wonder why somebody living on the prairies would write about a French astronomer. I think it was growing up under all those wide skies and staring at the star at night, or the skies at night and at the stars, and wondering about the universe. And so about 18 years ago, I took a course in astronomy at the University of Winnipeg to just to feed that hunger of mine for knowledge. And that's where I heard about the transits of Venus in the 18th century and this huge international effort that was mounted to measure them so that they could establish the distance between the Earth and the Sun. That's when I first heard of Le Gentil, a French astronomer who gave up nearly everything that mattered to him in the quest for this knowledge. And I thought, this is a wonderful subject for a play. And because it was Venus, I thought, it's obviously got to be a love story. Le Gentil is based on a real character. The other characters in the play and in the libretto, of course, are imagined. And they include three women, his mother, his housekeeper, and the housekeeper's young daughter, Celeste. And the play begins, and the opera begins with Le Gentil coming back from Paris, very excited. He's got a ship, in spite of the fact that it's wartime. He's going off to India. He's going to chart the transit of Venus. In the play, he celebrates with Desmarais, his assistant, who's going with him. In the opera, he celebrates with Desmarais, and a chorus of men have a drinking song, and it's all great. And then we move to act scene two, and it's suddenly we're with the women, and the tone is very different. The women know that he's back, and they suspect he's got a ship, and they're all upset about it. His mother, of course, he's going to be gone for 3 years. She's worried about his safety. Celeste is in love with him and can't understand why he would be going off to leave her for 3 years if he's in love with her, as he says he is. And Margot, her mother, the housekeeper, had an affair with Le Gentil some years ago, fell in love with him. The feelings weren't reciprocated, and she's worried about her daughter, the same thing happening to her daughter. So before Le Gentil can go away, he has to resolve these issues. And so the first thing that he does at his mother's request is he speaks to Margot, the housekeeper, and tells her that he's in love with Celeste and is planning to marry her when he comes back. Not an easy thing to do under the circumstances. So the first thing you're going to see is the scene from the play in which this happens. And playing Le Gentil will be Arne McPherson, and playing Margot will be Ardith Boxall. And then we'll move to the opera, and you'll see the same scene sung.
You wanted to see me?
Yes. You got my list?
Just now.
You'll manage all right?
There's a great deal to do and very little time. We'll manage. It's going to be a long 3 years, Guillaume.
Listen, Margot, there's something I have to say to you. I should have said it weeks ago, but I thought, well, something unforeseen has happened, something rather strange.
It must be strange indeed. I don't believe I've ever seen you at a loss for words.
I'm in love with your daughter, and I intend to marry her when I return, with your blessing, I hope. There, that's it. That's all of it. You expected this, I think.
No.
I thought Celeste might have...
Not at all.
Or that you would assume, given the...
What was I to assume? I mean, clearly she's infatuated with you, but I'm hardly in a position to condemn her for that. And as for you, well, it didn't occur to me... Have you told her? Oh, yes, of course you have. She knows perfectly well that you intend to marry her. And Madame, your mother, she knows as well?
Yes.
Everyone knows. Everyone's known all along, apparently, except me. But now you've told me. Now, on the eve of your departure, why? If it wasn't necessary to tell me before.
It seemed important to clarify things.
Important to whom? Celeste?
To Mother.
Ah, she put you up to it.
She asked me to speak to you, yes.
Otherwise, you wouldn't have bothered.
Definitely not. Better a storm at sea than this.
Poor Guillaume, I suppose I am behaving rather badly. Like a wife, in fact, when in reality it seems my role is to be that of mother-in-law. Don't.
Please.
Don't touch me.
For God's sake, Margot, you had to know.
How? How could I possibly know when no one would speak to me? Every time your name comes up, she flies out of the room. And every time I look at you, you turn away.
You could have asked. You could have come to me at any time.
Yes, and you could have come to me.
I was negligent,
I was
obviously.
Blind.
I swear to you, Margot, on everything that's holy, this is the last thing I ever would have dreamt I would have to tell you.
You haven't touched her, have you?
Margot.
Oh, God, no, of course you haven't. Another man, one of those mincing, scented courtiers you so seem to enjoy mocking, a man like that wouldn't hesitate, out of the mother's bed and into the daughter's. But for you, of course, that would be out of the question. No doubt, that makes her even more appealing.
What are you saying?
Oh, Guillaume, I know you so well. It's not the aim that intrigues you, it's the quest. And it's a meager quest indeed without an obstacle.
Listen to me. There are several reasons why I haven't touched Celeste, one of which is my respect for you. But to suggest that that somehow makes her more appealing is...
Doesn't it?
I refuse to go on with this conversation. I've had enough women in my life, I assure you, to know when I've found one worth waiting for.
This is my daughter we're talking about. This is my Celeste, my jewel. And you want me to believe that you love her? How can I? How can I believe that a man in your position with your experience could fall head over heels in love with... My God, Guillaume, she's so young.
I'm aware of that, believe me. That's why I think it's just as well I'm going away.
So
by the time
young,
I get back...
And so impetuous.
She's a little impetuous.
Very.
Yes, all right. She's very young and very impetuous. That doesn't change anything.
I won't have her tossed aside. Not my Celeste. She's my only...
Enough! Enough of this! I'm not a weather vane spinning in the wind. I've told you my intentions. Now you can plan around them. Do you understand?
Perfectly.
Good. Margot, I realize our relationship, the one we had, ended badly. But I wouldn't want to leave here tomorrow morning, knowing you felt that I'd misled you in some way. I didn't do that, did I?
No.
You're sure?
Quite.
Good. Thank God for that. I have your blessing, then?
Pardon me?
On this marriage.
What have I ever denied you?
Now you're going to hear Mark Boudin as Le Gentil and Donalyn Grills as Margot singing the same scene.
Victor's going to hear it from the house.
Daughter, and when intend to marry her. There, that's it. That's all of it. You must have expected this.
No.
I thought Celeste might have.
Not at all.
Or that you would assume.
What was I to assume? I know she's taken with you. I can hardly condemn her for that. As for you, well, it didn't occur to me. She knows, doesn't she? And your mother knows. Everyone's known, but me. Have you touched her?
No.
No doubt that makes her even more appealing.
Listen to me. I haven't touched her. And to suggest that makes her more appealing.
Doesn't it?
I've had enough women to know when I found one worth waiting for.
This is my child we're talking. To protect her with my very life, I came here a poor young widow with a fatherless child. Who told me love, Celeste.
Holy, I never dreamed the day would come when I would tell you this.
She's so young.
That's why I think it's just as well I'm going away. Yes, she's very young and very impetuous.
I won't ever toss aside, not my Celeste.
Enough, enough of this. I'm not a weather vane spinning in the wind. Now, do you understand?
Perfectly.
Good. Margot, I realize
I should have mentioned that the pianist is Solores Miller. You'll be hearing her again a bit later.
Did we want to talk about that scene? The one thing, it seems to me, is that you...
It moves Victor every time he hears it.
Very sad. Go ahead.
The one thing is that you essentially move into a big scena, as they call, for Margot, right? As opposed to being more a scene between the two of them. And it becomes much more about Celeste than I think it is in the play. Because the subtext is that it's about the relationship of Gentil and Margot, not so much Celeste is in there. And it becomes more about Celeste. They're nodding, so I guess I'm right. did it strike anyone else? Do you have any questions about that? Or? No? Okay.
Well. I think moving it to Celeste the way you have has given even more power to Margot.
Yes, I think so. That you've that was a very deliberate move. That you need, did you ask for a big scene for Margot, or needed her aria? Or?
Well, essentially, yes.
Okay, that's fair.
Because you know, we hope the opera is done more than once, and you want to be able to cast great singers across all of the roles. And when we had the draft of the libretto, we sort of went back and went, you know what, we don't really have something substantial for Margot to sing, and for future singers and for future companies to be able to hire a very good singer for that role. So it started from a kind of very practical basis,
right.
How will future producers be able to attract good singers for all the roles in it? And so they obviously have to have something great to sing. It then became, from a storytelling point of view, what part of the play, what part of the story could we enhance, and what had enough emotional stake to express musically and substantively. And ultimately it became this moment in the story.
Okay.
Yeah, in the play, Margot's story is understated in a sense. We see her in that scene. We don't see her again until 6 years later, and by then she's made the adjustment to the fact that Le Gentil is... There will be a marriage, hopefully, between Le Gentil and Celeste. And we never hear the backstory. We don't hear about her coming to the house as a widow with a child. And we really don't understand what she... it's implied in the acting, but the words are not in the play to express what she goes through in the scene when this news is delivered. What she has to deal with then for the rest of the story.
Okay. You want to move on or anything else? Or? I think that's sort of...
Let's have a look at the next scene.
Okay,
sure.
Okay, so the next scene, I mentioned that Le Gentil had to clean things up before he could get away, and so the next challenge is to explain to Celeste, his young fiancée, why going away to chart the transit of Venus is more important at this point in his life than staying to be with her. And so he tries throughout the last scene in Act One, he talks about the fact that he was going to be a priest, but then he heard an astronomer speak and he realized that he could serve God in a different way and that he was called to do that. And that doesn't make any kind of an impression on her. And then he tries to explain the importance of the mission and what they will learn, and that doesn't make an impression. And finally, what you will see now, he says to her, "Come here, Celeste, I want to show you something." And he takes her to the telescope and asks her to look at the sky. And this is the moment that you're going to see. You'll see, again, Arden McPherson as Le Gentil, and Ardith Boxall is going to transform herself from a 35-year-old mother into a 15-year-old girl and read Celeste.
Come here, Celeste. I want to show you something.
I don't want to look at any of your cold stars.
Please. Look through the lens and tell me what you see. Yes, I know. It's astonishing. Enough to stop the heart. Try again. What do you see?
A lot of stars.
And?
A great white ball.
Venus. Brightest object in the night sky. Brighter even than the moon. First star of the evening, last star of the morning. Though not, in fact, a star at all, but a planet. A milky white, luminous disk of a planet that gleams in the night sky like a star. No wonder men look at her and think of love. No wonder men love. For the Babylonians, it was a luminous lion that roamed the night sky from east to west. But the great god El was jealous of its brightness, so every day at dawn he had it put to death. And every day at dusk, the lion rose from the dead to roam the skies again. For the Mesopotamians, it was the goddess Ishtar, queen of the heavens, daughter of the moon. She was a lot like you, this Ishtar. She was young, beautiful, or not beautiful, if you insist. She was impulsive and quite contradictory. In fact, she was the goddess of contradictory forces. Fire and fire quenching, fair play and enmity, rejoicing and tears. She was often seen in the company of a lion, and when the lion roared, that was thunder. For certain cultures in Africa, she was both the evening and the morning star, the wives of the moon, sometimes the sister of the sun. For the Greeks, she was Aphrodite, goddess of love. For the Romans, Venus. And for me, Guillaume Joseph Hyacinthe Jean-Baptiste Le Gentil de la Galassière, she is destiny. What's the matter?
The way you talk.
Do you like it? If you like it, I'll fill your days with it, and your nights as well. I'll tell you all about the stars and the planets, and you'll tell me about love. And when we've exhausted those subjects, if we ever do, we can argue about how beautiful you are. But not yet, Celeste. First, I go after Venus. Then, I come back to you. Will you wait for me? Can you trust me and do it? You can. I can see it in your eyes. My God, Celeste, isn't it incredible? With all the things there are to look at in the world, that my eye should fall on you.
I'm so afraid.
Hush. Listen to the bells.
Promise me you won't forget the little face of Celeste.
How could I?
Promise me that you'll come back.
Oh, I'll come back, God willing.
Don't say that. Don't ever say that.
Why not, you silly girl?
Well, I don't think it's absolutely certain that God approves of us.
What kind of talk is that? Wasn't it God who brought us together in the first place?
Well, I don't know.
Of course it was.
Why?
Why did he bring us together? Maybe he couldn't resist it. Go back to your bed, Celeste. Sleep. And dream of me. Can you do that? Can you dream about me while I'm gone?
Yes.
Then I'll be with you every night. What more can we ask than that?
He just said he wanted to put something back in, and so I want to get it in writing. All right, now we're going to hear Mark Boudin again and singing Le Gentil, and Naomi Foreman will sing Celeste. She's not in your program. Unfortunately, it was an oversight, but this is Naomi Foreman, and again, Solaris Miller will be at the piano.
here, Celeste. I want to show you something.
I don't want to look at your cold stars. Oh,
Slow down. Crying?
No. Thinking.
Thinking. All the time. That seems, in a way, closer to what's in the play. You know, the idea and the coming together at the end, of course, to do their duet is absolutely essential if you're going to have an opera, especially the finale to Act One. Is that right?
Yes, the end of Act One.
Yeah, that's the end of Act One. Anybody react to that or? Comparison or?
I don't know what it was that you say have to go back in, but I think you have to have her say, don't say that.
Don't say which?
When Celeste says, he says, God willing. And
oh, don't say that. Yeah, don't say that. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And why do you think it should go back in? That's a good point.
She challenges him quite a bit in that scene. Like, this is the very end of the scene, right? So we'll certainly think about that. It's a good suggestion. But she does stand up to him, even though she's 15 and he's 35 at the beginning. And by the time we get into Act Two, she's 6 years older. She's a young woman. She's educated herself. He turned her on to the wonder of the universe and the beauty of knowledge, and so she's educated herself in his absence, and she is a very different person when he comes back in Act Two than he was when he left her in Act One. So part of the story, both in the play and the opera, is about her transition into an independent woman from this young girl that he fell in love with at first.
Well, we could open it for questions, unless you have.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
We will take any question.
The substantial change in the scene and duet is how Lujanti's passion for science, in particular for Venus, is expressed in language in Maureen's play.
Oh, true.
And so the monologue that Arne did with for Lujanti, when he's saying what Venus meant for different cultures, and then what it means for him, which is his destiny, was reworked substantially and reduced substantially. And I guess replaced with the sweep of music in terms of getting his passion across. So that's a very significant difference in between how the scene would work in the theater and how it works in the opera.
No, that's fair, although I can see some directors would take that speech, right, and they'd go, well, let's cut that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's really about him, so let's go. But that's another question. But yes, I think that's fair, that it comes out in the music then. But I don't know. It just seemed, in a way, closer in terms of the emotion of the speeches, you know? Did you feel that you were changing a lot there, or just cutting a lot there? You know what I mean?
I think emotionally it's true to what was in the play. The speech that where he talks about mythology, what Venus has been through history and through mythology, happens to be one of my favorites. No director's cutting it when I'm around.
No, fair enough.
But I gave up every line in that speech very reluctantly, didn't I, Victor? We cut. Okay.
We sliced and sliced and sliced.
All right. So finally.
Even the Mesopotamians. Yeah. left. Yeah. You know, which...
Tell them the line count story, Victor.
Well, you know, this is the line count story. Last August, when we were working on the libretto, how many lines is this libretto? Because we don't want to have a five-hour opera, right? And it's very tricky because, I mean, there's so much fabulous language in this play. I mean, Marine writes just such incredible language that cries out for music. But we have to draw the line somewhere. And so I started counting lines in operas. Aida 850, Peter Grimes 1300, Marriage of Figaro 1950, on and on. And we were at about 1500 then, I think, 1500 lines. Now, the lines were shorter than a lot of those other operas, but, you know, we had a reading last August, right, and we timed it. And then we're kind of all trying to guess after the reading. Well, the reading was about an hour and 15 minutes, I think, right? So we're thinking, okay, well, if it's the music takes twice as long, that's 2 hours and a half because the music wasn't all written. So we're kind of guessing. Okay, so we wanted to arrive, at least I wanted to, as the composer, I didn't want to write any music until the libretto was pretty well done, because then you're kind of have a sense of the proportions of things and what the thematic content of it is and where the themes are going to go. So the number of lines was extremely important in terms of just the kind of the sheer kind of logistics of arriving at the length that we're at now. And then we had some workshops in Toronto and began to see other things. Well, maybe that could go. Maybe that little "the" could go there. We were literally cutting single words at the end.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, to try and shave every little bit off we could. But, I mean, we don't know. I mean, that now, I think we've all kind of come to the point where I don't know what we could cut. You know, the Mesopotamians were the last people to go.
Yeah.
And have you done that with music as well? You thought, have you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We've been ruthless. Everything anything that can go, it's got to go.
We've had about, I think, 6 workshops of the material now, some with Donna Lynn and Mark and Naomi and other local singers and the chorus. And then we have in June, then we were in Toronto and we did some workshop with the cast that will perform it, Russell Braun and Gene Stillwell and Monica Huseman and Colin Ainsworth. Judy Force couldn't be there, but Lynn McMurtry participated in that workshop. And we're trying to find a day to go back and do some more work on Act 3. But throughout that whole process, it's been a process of continually refining the work, both dramatically and musically, so that we can be as succinct as possible, and to keep the whole thing moving.
Yep.
No floating.
No floating.
No floating.
I have to tell this story because I wrote a musical with Michael Eugene Benson, who was the president of the Wellspring Festival. Nikki Goldschmidt, who was a very well-known character in Canadian opera, had an office up in the Metro Center right near the Royal Alec Theatre in Toronto, and one day I happened to go up. I thought, well, maybe Nicky's in his office. I'll just go up there and say hello. And I said, I've been working on this thing with Eugene. He said, well, he said, I only have one piece of advice for you. He says, and this is the composer. This is for all Canadian opera writers. He said, no floating. And I said, no floating. Yeah, he said, you know, he said, if there's any note or word which is superfluous to the pursuit of the drama. Now, this is a musician, this is a singer telling us this. It's got to go. And I think that was that's a great piece of advice. No floating.
Any other question? Okay. So make it more like a Zingspiel or...
Can I speak to that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Singers don't speak very well, unfortunately. Same as actors don't necessarily, you know, they're not singers. Actors, unless they do musical theater singers, but actors don't speak very well. Singers don't speak very well. So that's right away when you go into that other convention, you're treading on very dangerous ground. Well, that's not really speaking, though. It's another another musical convention, you know.
It's not like what Singspiels speak, which is a German tradition of the magic flute and operas like that, where there's almost, I guess, like a musical, kind of thing. Or Gilbert and Sullivan, but they're specifically trained for that in speaking. So I think you're right. If you listen to opera singers doing Die Fledermaus or something, it's hearing them speak the words. As opposed to actors doing it. But.
Well, we have a good guess.
It's not 5 hours.
We know it's not 5 hours. Well, we have sort of variously timed it. The conductor, James Mina, timed it at 2 hours. The running time without intermission, 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I think I had timed it about 2 hours and 45 minutes, just playing it over at what I thought were the right tempos. And we've done some snipping since then, so we hope we've maybe gained 5 minutes. But when all the 65 people get down there in the pit, then there's a lot of slippage in there, you know. It takes time for that thing to sound. And even though Mr. Mina will be, you know, putting the spurs to the horses, there's always that little thing, and we don't know how much that little thing is going to eat up or expand to.
Yes.
In design.
So we have the sets and the costumes are being designed by Brian Perchulak, who's a well-known Canadian theater designer, has designed a lot of work in Winnipeg. And so we're trying to create a world that is really sort of reflective of not the atmosphere of the time, but the nuances of each act, if you will. So... And reflective of some of the ideas of the opera, the universe, the God, our relationship, what does God mean to people, and that's sort of reflected in the architecture of the house in which this takes place. At the sky is always apparent. It is set in the period, so there are period costumes. They are more, though, the silhouette of the period rather than being historically accurate. Because even with the play, the language of the play is contemporary language. It's not period language. So even when we produced the play, we tried to capture the sort of essence of the qualities of the scenes, a kind of sense of period, but not necessarily being historically accurate. So in the first act, when Le Gentil is in the house and he's predominant in the household, it has a very mechanical feel to it. There's astrolabes and scientific instruments and telescopes in the house. In the second act, when he's been away for 6 years and they're expecting his return, and the women have prepared a special meal for him, so there's a big banquet table, and the place is covered in flowers, and that has a very feminine, soft feel to it. And then in the third act, and not giving anything away here because it was done as the play, so he's been declared as dead, and they've closed up the household, and so it has a very sort of oppressive sort of feel to it. And with regard to lighting, too, the story takes place at very sort of specific points of time, both seasonally and in the day. So it arrives. He arrives at the very top of the story amidst a big thunderstorm at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then that day sort of that day we follow that day throughout throughout the day, that time throughout the day. And so there's different looks in terms of how the sun might play on the set and that kind of thing. So a long-winded answer to say, yes, the visuals are incorporated in the process of creating the opera.
Go ahead.
Well, I didn't catch all of your question, but I think what you were asking about was how did it feel to be cutting lines, and that hurt a lot all the way through, and it wasn't until I started to hear the music that I began to understand that what we were creating was a new
piece.
A different art form, and it lived in would live on the stage in a very different way. And I have always felt that music is a direct line to the heart, and so I think it was obvious in the two excerpts that you saw that these, like in opera, you know exactly how people feel because it's all out there on the table. And whereas in drama, you spend a lot of time building in subtleties and subtext, and giving that up was hard too. Like having the faith to give it up, and then see that it could still work, and we could still care about these characters and follow the story.
It's also rare because you're adapting your own piece, which is not often done. You mentioned Porgy earlier, mm-hmm. Victor.
Mm-hmm.
Where Du Bois Hayward had written a novel and then written the play, and then Ira Gershwin wrote the lyrics, really. There's a lot of all that went on.
Yeah, it's interesting because actually the novel's written by Du Bois Hayward, then his wife
did the play.
He and his wife wrote, because she was a very accomplished playwright,
yeah.
as well. He was a novelist, she was a playwright. So she had a big hand in the adaptation. And then Gershwin and Ira and Du Bois Hayward actually wrote the opera. So right. Dorothy Hayward wasn't involved in the opera. It's interesting. The difficulty of transformation is.
So it's as I say, it's rare for the original creator to be involved. A lot of people that take something and adapt it. But mm-hmm. So that makes it.
Oh, pretty easy.
We've had discussions like that. There have been moments where I felt that without knowing anything about composition, that the music wasn't necessarily supporting the emotional truth of the moment. But Victor knew the story so well by the time he started writing. Well, he waited through 12 drafts, so he knew it really well, and I knew the characters really well. So and not a lot of that has been necessary.
No. I think we have the 12 drafts. A lot of discussion about the characters and their emotional lives and what their goals were and everything else before I put one note on the paper. So I knew those people pretty well by that point, by the 12th draft. So, but I was always open to Maureen's suggestions. I mean, she's a musician as well as a librettist. So. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, no, that's true, because she'd say, well, I kept saying, she said, could I have a copy of the music? Because I'd like to play it on the piano. And I said, oh, that's great. I mean, because if you have a librettist who actually is a musician of some kind, they can check those melodies you've written and listen to those harmonies and understand everything. But what was interesting, I have to tell you a little anecdote about the very first piece that I played Larry and Maureen. And that was the there was a
Madame Sauvy's aria?
No, it was there was a the Celeste sings an aria, I Can't Remember When I Wasn't in Love. And there's a particular chord in there. I don't know if I can play it or not. On the piano. If it's plugged in.
I still go. No, I don't.
But after that, I never heard about that chord anymore. And
it's all the other chords I've been worried about.
Larry has a list. But it's kind of interesting. That was a kind of a pivotal point for all of us, I think, because that was the first piece of music that they heard that day at Maureen's house. They didn't know what to expect.
Did you have to explain that it was a motif? Then,
no.
That all the way through?
I said, oh, just wait.
That's right.
Okay. So they did. Yep. Okay.
Anything else?
Well, she's just come out of a convent.
So she's really confused.
Well, go and see if you know Massenet's Manon, she comes out of a convent too, and things happen right away. So, in a very different way. So. A lot of these French girls come out of convents and...
They get wild.
They get wild. Or they react in very different ways. But well, maybe just one... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's one part in the play and in the opera where she talks about how, as a little girl at five, which is when she came to live in the house with her mother, she would creep into his study and watch him while he worked. And so this is the basis of the aria that Victor just mentioned. I can't remember when I wasn't in love. And so for her, it's gone back like forever. She's looked up to this man and admired him. And I think that they just haven't had the intellectual conversation at the end of this scene that they will have later. Mm-hmm. It's not an intellectual meeting by any means right now. And he figures he'll be back in 3 years and she'll be 18 and, you know.
Maybe one or two more. Yep.
This is for Maureen. You touched on this a little bit. But I'd like to know what your reaction was to hearing your words transformed into music after all the spoken dialogue they had a particular resonance for. And you were in the humility. And then they take on a completely different form.
Well, it's kind of a high, you know. It really is wonderful, actually. It's going to be very hard for me to read the play or hear the play performed again and not hear the music in the background. I think the music that Victor's written is very, very beautiful, and it brings tears to my eyes many, many times, and I feel the hair going up and down in my arm, and it's been a very exciting process, but it's and a very emotional one. But I'm really proud of what Victor's written and how it supports the story and these characters. And so it's really exciting, actually, to hear it sung. I'm looking forward to hearing the orchestra. I haven't heard an orchestra behind it yet. There was some of that, or changing words, so that you had a certain rhythm. Most of the, as Victor said, I mean, he wrote from the libretto, but there was the odd time when he had written some music and said, could you come up with some words that will fit the music I've written? But mostly, finding a word that ends on an open note rather than a closed sound, that sort of thing. We did quite a bit of that, finding words that were simpler, maybe, than what were in the play, and express things more directly, that kind of thing. Because there isn't, as we've said, much room for subtlety or in opera. It's got to be pretty bold. So,
there's things that we discovered in the process too. That some words sound extremely strange when they're sung, which you wouldn't think that because the play is going on, but all of a sudden when there was a relationship which you heard in that scene. Margot, I realize our relationship ended badly, and we originally had relationship in there.
Yeah.
And we had it came twice actually. Mm-hmm. And now it's been taken out both places because it just sounded very strange when it was sung in the context of the convention of people singing and the convention of opera to hear that word in this kind of period of time in the love story. It sounded all of a sudden kind of took it to, I think, a more pedestrian level because we're trying to be more poetic, I think. It came out like a bullet.
And what did you substitute?
It's I realize you and I ended badly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. There was also, Maureen had some, in the play, what is it? She says, Celeste says, bugger that.
Bugger him. Yeah.
Bugger him, yeah. And I said, you know what? I said, I don't have any problem with the word. I don't have any problem with the emotion. But I said, in the context of people singing and everything else, it's going to be. Now, if it were another kind of play, another kind of opera, mm-hmm. like we did something, I think it was on the street. Jerry Springer, the opera.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean,
there's tons of swearing, and it's great.
Tons of swearing, and it's quite brilliant.
It's brilliant.
It's very, very funny, and it's wonderful. But that's the kind of the métier of the piece, and so bugger him in this context, even though probably because Madame Savisa's, where do you suppose she learned a word like that? Not at the convent, right? So. But there's never time to capitalize on that when we were cutting, you see. So it's just an interesting thing that to discover that.
Okay. Well, we're almost at, I think, out of time, unless there's another question. Great. Well, we hope to all see you in November at the opera. Okay, one more.
As a writer, I started off writing short stories, and I thought I would probably do what most writers do, eventually move into writing novels. But I took I kind of tossed a coin. Do I take a creative writing class from David Arneson, or do I go down to the University of Winnipeg and take a playwriting class? And the coin came down on the side of playwriting. And I felt right away that I'd totally found my genre. And partly it was because I just loved actors, and I loved working with actors, and I loved the ephemerality of theater. It's a heightened existence for the time that your play is in rehearsal and on stage, and then it's over, and there's something about that that I like very much. I also don't like writing description, so, you know, if you write a play, you don't have to write description. So, you tell your story through dialogue, pure and simple, and I just love it, and I took to it. I also was looking at, I was looking at selling a short story and maybe getting $150 at that time, and I thought, I'm going to have to write an awful lot of short stories, or I can try something else. And it just happened that every play I wrote was picked up and produced, and it was a matter of timing and luck and meeting the right people and having the Manitoba Association of Playwrights behind me, and meeting Larry, because Larry directed my first two plays at Manitoba Theatre Centre. And then moving into libretto, writing a libretto was not something I had ever planned, but I love music, and I really welcomed the opportunity to try to do it. And that's sort of the story, that's the trajectory.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Thanks, Maureen, Victor.
Thank you.
Thank you.